and which is a local disbursement group for the National Endowment for the Humanities. And the Humanities Foundation has given considerable help to Augusta over the past 5 or 6 years, always with the stipulation that we do these interpretive kinds of public programs. And that's caused us perhaps to do some growing that we might not have otherwise necessarily have done. There are many programs like Augusta which do not look at the kinds of issues which are raised by the performance and the execution of various folk arts and folk music. This series has caused us to explore various kinds of issues growing out of the practice and performance of this kind of activity that we do here. So I think it's been a good and valuable thing. And we've had a lot of pretty lively discussions. The subject for tonight has to do with the way in which various cultures in this region have influenced one another historically and into the present. We're probably going to be talking mostly about music tonight, but perhaps the discussion could apply to other kinds of activities as well. And we've assembled a vast pool of wisdom here, knowledge and experience.
We're going to discuss paneling.
We're going to discuss paneling?
Channeling.
Ever since Frank decided to remodel his house, he's been impossible. So I think the way to proceed with this might be to go around first and have introductions from people. And would you please give your name and tell where you're from and tell a little bit about how you got into playing the kind of music you play now and what it means to you and where you think it might have, what you think its historical roots might be. Franklin, could we start with you, please? Frank George.
Well, I've already been through that today. Can you hear me? No.
Hey!
It's not working. It's just too cold. Oh, it is.
I hear you.
Well, you're paying attention. If you could all speak very pretty loud. We're not going to amplify. It's much more intimate. Everything's nice and quiet.
All right. I've gone and told everybody where I was from. I'm raised in Mercer County in the Rope Grove. If anybody would have told me 30 years ago that something like Augusta would occur, especially an old time week, I'd have probably hit them over the head with an axe handle. But there seems to be some good coming out of this. I'm thinking mainly of preservation of Appalachian music. And that's only one little part of the culture, so you can spend the rest of your life studying Appalachian culture. And what do you want me to say?
Well, why don't you, I know you've already told them once, why don't you tell them again about where you...
Oh, you're talking about the early history.
Yeah.
All right. For those of you who haven't heard this, I was born in Appalachian and somehow never was quite ashamed of it. And I learned to play music at an early age. I was about 7 when I learned to play the banjo, learned mostly from my grandfather. On a homemade banjo my dad made, wish I'd have brought it with me. I was about 9, learned to play a fiddle, a homemade fiddle my dad made for me. And at that time, this music was sort of frowned on, especially by local people. They made may have been somebody somewhere else I don't know about interested in it. But by that time, you see, we had these damn infernal things called a radio. And people turned that on, and they listened to Lamplight in the Valley in 21 years and Brown Ferry Blues, and they forgot about Cripple Creek and Arkansas Traveler and some of them old ballads. And so that started to ruin the thing, and when the box came in, that one-eyed monster, that just about wiped it out. Why should a woman sing Barbara Allen to her child when she can watch Guiding Light? And why should Johnny learn to sharpen a knife or pick a banjo or figure out on squirrel hunting or something when he can watch a damn football game or the wrestling matches? So that's what's happened to the culture. It's been advertised out, mediumed out. Another problem we had is the schools. I hate to get in the school system because it's been shot for 40 years. They never taught any local history. In fact, they never taught hardly any history at all. So nobody learned about Appalachian culture. You had a little old West Virginia history course, and they even give out a little tin badge. You remember them things? Mm-hmm. Tin on, you get ones. Two-third year or something, green, red, and something like that. That was a golden horseshoe thing, which is a pretty good idea. But we started that Appalachian, oh, what was that darn thing we started one time? I've had kids that were golden horseshoe winners come up and say, well, I didn't realize I didn't learn anything in the golden horseshoe history thing. But I did learn something in that. I can't remember the program. So, to make a long story short, this is a good effort. I don't know who started this up, but if my wife ever gets here, well, I don't really worry about that, but if she ever shows up, she's got a picture from the very first Augusta, and I forget the year, she'll tell you, and it might be interesting for some of you who want to see just some little something that happened here. I don't know whether it's somebody walking out through the field or something, but anyway, it's the very first Augusta. So, whatever means or who or money, I don't know, but it's a pretty good program, I think. There's a few things wrong with it, but I'm not going into that. It's like on the last day when I get my check. But I've had fun. Only been here one day. I've had a good time. I enjoyed my class. They seem to be enjoying it. They've learned something, I think. Either that or they're lying. And so we'll probably have a pretty good week. I'm just talking about instrument-wise. That's all I deal with. Feeling bad. So I'm not going to stay here all night. So I'm going to turn it over. Oh, you want to say something? I was going to hand you a mic, but don't bring them this. Yes. We'll just ignore it. You mean they never heard nothing I said?
that system's off. It's something. It's another part of the back up there.
It's either the lights or the air conditioning.
If you all can try speaking just a little bit louder, more clearly, then everybody can hear you.
They can't understand much, also in English.
Ron, would you tell us your name and a little bit about your...
Well, speak out so we can hear.
I'll try. My name is Ron Mullinix, and I was raised about 25 miles east of here. I started playing music when I was, about 14. And we had a fairly strong music tradition in that area at the the time. There was a the volunteer fire department had an open air platform there in the town of Harmon, and they had a square dance there every Saturday night during the summer, and that really served to keep a lot of the music going. It finally kind of died out about 1970 probably. But up until that point, there was a lot of music, certainly all the time during the summer, and there were a lot of people who actively played. And the way I got started playing music and got interested in it was some people in my family. My mother played music, and several of her brothers and sisters played music and played at the dances and were actively involved there. And so I kind of got started just by osmosis more than anything, I guess. And as far as where the music came from and the kind of music it was, to some extent, I guess when I was a teenager there in the mid-60s, some of the radio and recorded music influence was there. It wasn't unaffected. The music we were playing wasn't unaffected by recorded music or radio music, because not very many people were playing clawhammer style, the old-time style banjo. I remember a couple people who did, but most people were playing more of a three-finger style, trying to do a bluegrass style banjo. The fiddle players were still playing the old tunes and so forth, but they were listening to newer fiddlers and recorded music. And so there was probably a little bit of influence there, maybe not as, it certainly wasn't as obvious as it was with the banjo, because it's just such a great, it's easy to see the difference on the banjo. The fiddle is a lot more subtle thing. But there probably was some influence there, but still they were playing a lot of the old tunes, especially the dance tunes. As far as where the music came from in that area originally, I'll try. if a lot of the books you read talk about how the music is a direct evolutionary descendant of Scotch-Irish music, and I'm sure that that's mostly true, but I'm also sure that it can't be 100% true, because there were too many German people who made up too big a part of the early settlement, and they had to have played a role in bringing that music in. The area where I came from, I'd say it was probably a 50-50 split among the early settlers. Probably 50% of them were Germans, and the other 50% were British Isles. And that's one thing that bothers me a little bit when I read about the music and the scholarly dissertations on where the music came from, and everything is attributed directly to the Scotch-Irish influence, and nothing is ever said about the German influence. And I think that's a subject that needs a lot of study, and I'm not saying I have the answers to it, but that's something we ought to be thinking about a little bit. There's a lot of room for a lot of work there in trying to trace those influences back.
For example, if you look in Pendleton County history, which was written in 1910, they have an appendix in the back which shows you what the German names, the surnames that people had, that they changed, they anglicized to anglicized versions. For example, the German family Zirkel is now Circle, and that's where Circleville comes from. It was originally Zirkelville. So there was a real anti-German feeling. This is before the First World War. In 1910, there was already this Anglicization had already gone on.
Can I comment on that briefly?
Sure.
There is no doubt in my mind that the Pluck Dulcimer is descended from German influence. I can't prove it, but I don't care.
I agree with you. It's got to be.
Thank you.
No, I'm about finished.
I don't know if there's anything else that that you would like for me to expand on.
Well, that gets us started. Maybe we could hear from Jimmy Costa, who comes from, has some real interesting cultural roots. Talking about immigration and people settling in the mountains. Jim's from Hinton, West Virginia, and comes from railroading families, I guess, don't you, Jim?
Yeah,
on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up in the southeastern part of the state. I guess from here it's exactly due south, about 140 miles in Summers County, West Virginia. And my parents both the maternal and paternal side, the grandparents on the paternal and maternal side of my family, my father's people, my last name is Costa, and they were Southern Italian and come from down in Reggio Calabria. In fact, they came here to Randolph County, about the first place they landed, in about 1897, and worked in these woods around here, my great-grandfather and my granddad and my great-uncle. And my great-grandfather was a blacksmith. My grandfather was, at that age, about 12 years old at that time. And they carried water to the wood hicks in these woods here. The wood hick was the equivalent of a northern lumberjack. In the south, they're called wood hicks. And then eventually they lived around Beverly and Daly in these little camps, and then they eventually went further south. We're up here in the northeastern part, I guess, and they went further south. And then my grandfather Costa started, he was a foreman over a crew of Italians building railroad grades. So my grandfather was a laborer in a sense, a labor foreman. For the railroad, where they would build the railroad grades. And then my mother's father was a conductor on the railroad. So that's some of the influence in my family. And then the music that I heard, I guess, growing up, first time when I was probably about 5 years old, I heard a fellow play a clawhammer banjo. I've thought about this, been thinking about this very much recently, where I first heard a banjo played, because that probably is my main instrument. My father had a cable system in our town, television cable system. In fact, he still yet has that. And his tower was on a little mountain about 10 miles out of our town. And the folks that rented him the land to build that tower owned a farm just below that. And as kids will be kids, I would go with my father during the days that he was building this television complex there, cable system complex. I'd go off the tower mountain, we called it, and go down there to that farm where this family of Cales has lived. And Harlow Cales at that time was in his late 40s. We're talking about 1953 or 4. And he would play the five-string banjo the old time way. He played clawhammer. And he had a son that was playing who at that time was about 16 years old. And so that's the first time I ever heard music, old-time music, because I lived in a pretty progressive neighborhood close to the town of Hinton. And the music had once been in my family, on my mother's side especially. There was a great uncle that was always heralded about being such a fine, in fact, he was a traveling banjo player. He originally grew up in Mercer County, and he played in the old style. But I'd never heard, the music was not directly in the family circle. My grandfather, Costa, still played the accordion a little bit. He played the old Italian melodies on the accordion. And then sometime between that age of 5 and 6, I saw and heard a banjo played. Then when I was around 13 years old, I got interested again. But at that point in time, my first influence, those folks left and moved. Mr. Cales had bad health and went to Arizona to live. And he was a railroad laborer, in fact, and he got a job somewhere out in that area. I don't remember what, but doing what. But they left, so he was no more of an influence. And I heard a banjo player that lived right down the street, literally, from me, who was at that time in his early 80s playing, but not clawhammer. He played a two-finger style that he had been taught by an old black gentleman as a young boy living in Monroe County. And so I heard him play when I was around 10 years old. When I was around 13, I wanted to learn the banjo. Went over to him, in fact. And he had since quit, and his banjo head was burst, and no strings on it. And he eventually gave me that old banjo, and then I fixed it up, and I would take it over to him, and he would tune it for me, and that was about all he could do.
What did you say,
burst? Yeah, the head was.
Busted.
Busted, yeah. So that's, I just started learning, I remember him, you know, trying to pick out a tune, say like Cripple Creek or something, but there again, not clawhammer, not like the first way I'd seen a banjo played. Of course, I was too young at 5 and 6 to realize even the difference. To me, some they were just playing a banjo. I liked that and I wanted to learn it. So in a real crazy course, I learned to play banjo pretty much self-taught until I finally... Mr. Kales did eventually come back to my area about a year after I'd been totally into trying to learn on my own, and he got me straightened out and showed me how to play clawhammer. And I'd already by that time developed a style of two-finger, because that was just all that evolved with me from what little I had been actually showed by Mr. Ballard. Yeah, and Lee Blankenship in the later, when I was about 18 or 19, I got around quite a fine old banjo player from over in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, yeah. So, and the fiddle and the guitar, I just was interested. I became interested in all the traditional music because I liked the sound of it, basically. I liked it, and the old songs, now the railroad songs, I play a lot of those. In my area, it was a railroad town. The town would not have been there had it not been for the railroad, CNO Railroad coming through. And so there were ballads within our county of railroad wrecks. In fact, ballads that eventually became nationally recorded. Wreck of the FFV was recorded many times by many artists through different times of our, even up to contemporary times. I think Joan Baez even recorded a version of it. That happened about a mile from my home. So I heard older people playing the guitar. The first thing I ever heard people playing on guitar were those railroad ballads and accompanying themselves on the guitar and playing the old finger and thumb style. So.
I grew up partly in Eastern West Virginia, around a place called Romney, and as a kid I heard a lot of old-time string band music, family music, that was played mostly at church socials on a hay wagon, and I eventually got close to and spent a lot of time with everybody I could find in that end of the state who played old-time music. And looking back on it now, I don't know how it went so far or so long kind of free of a lot of the influences we've been talking about. The music that I heard didn't seem to have been influenced by the radio. It was family music. It was tunes that had been played in those families right on down through in an unbroken way. It didn't sound like music you heard on the radio. And whether or not the people who played it wished it did or were glad it didn't, I don't know. They never said. But I'm bothered by some of the same questions that you are. I think the Scots-Irish explanation is a good one, but it's a little bit too simple, maybe. I know that this part of West Virginia was also settled by American people. And they're not very much talked about because very little is known about American people who settled this area. I'm talking about families that had lived in the Piedmont for 5 or 6 generations before they came here, or who had lived in other places in the South or the Upland South, who'd stayed in the woods, who were hunters and gatherers, and who obviously originated somewhere in the British Isles and carried styles of British folk music in their families. But by the time you've been somewhere 6 or 7 generations, you've had a chance to develop a style
and a repertoire and to be influenced by people around you. And so I always thought you had to ask, well, who was around at the time? Who was hanging out together? Who was influencing one another? And I think I was amazed to hear Ernie Carpenter tell me one time, because it was a thing I'd always wondered about. And he said that he had learned his fiddle playing largely from his grandfather, Squirrely Bill, who learned largely from his grandfather, who would have been Ernie's great-great-grandfather. And so with only one intermediary in that family, you had a fiddling tradition spanning a couple, almost 200 years, spanning five generations. And Ernie told me that his people played fiddle tunes that came from the Indians. Now, he didn't say that the Indians played fiddles, But there's a cluster of tunes that he talked about, tunes like the Indian Nation. But you have to retune the fiddle to play them, and they have an awful high, lonesome, haunting sound about them. And he always told me that those tunes came from the Indians. Well, it's not such an awfully surprising thing, since his great-great-grandfather married an Indian woman. And probably was not unlike a lot of other people who settled in the section of Braxton County where Ernie's people settled along the Elk River. In fact, many of the musicians, musical people that I've spent time with here in Central West Virginia, claim some kind of Indian forebears. And so you have to wonder what were those influences. Our history doesn't tell us that the Indians had any music to speak of. They beat on drums and carried on, but the books don't mention any kind of music. So you have to go back to oral sources like Ernie Carpenter, and you have to speculate about what it was like at that time and how much people really did influence one another. Certainly by the time a lot of family music got here to this part of West Virginia, it wasn't pure Scots-Irish anymore. It had bounced around a lot and had some of the corners knocked off of it and developed a feeling of its own, which I always thought was probably largely influenced by the terrain around here, by the geography around here. The music always sounded to me like the place looks and feels a little bit. So, and then there, black people have been in these mountains for a long time. They've been here as long as anybody, probably, except the Indians. And they had... They brought a whole sense of rhythm and a whole style to music. So where I am now in North Carolina, there's possibly even more evidence of Indian influence in local music and customs and so on. Because I live just a few miles from the Cherokee Reservation. So I'm really looking forward to pursuing these questions and going to the oldest people I can find and listening to how they sing and listening to how they express themselves and asking them what they think about these kinds of questions. Yes, sir.
You've heard the theory that the banjo came from Africa.
Well, I've heard it said that the banjo came from Africa, he said. Yeah.
Well, the Indians also had one, but I don't know how far back.
Uh-huh.
So maybe it was here all along, or maybe we got it from two sources.
Two sources.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about the banjo that the Indians had? Was it made of a gourd?
I can't tell you anything about it.
You know, that's funny because how many cultures have an instrument that's similar to the banjo? I mean, Chinese, Japanese?
All over Asia. All over Asia.
Skin heavy.
Oh, it wasn't important. conjecture.
In the course of living around here for many years, I heard some old ballads, unaccompanied ballads that were, I know of three ballads that were written from an Indian point of view. And they may not have been of Indian authorship at all. I wouldn't say that they were, but they were written from an Indian point of view anyway. And at the very least, they represent a real strong sentiment about the Indians who once lived in these parts and who were chased out of here. A sort of almost a longing, a kind of a lament, I think, for that way of life. So that's very much been on the minds of people in West Virginia, I think. Not everybody, everywhere, but a lot of people in a lot of places have thought about these things, and I feel have been... there are some lingering kinds of influences. If we had more time, I might sing you one of those old songs. But I'd rather turn now to Bill Wellington, who's thought a lot more about this banjo and its various influences than I have even. Bill?
Well, actually, I could say that the banjo is really the reason I'm here. Because, see, I'm sort of the oddball up here. I'm neither from this part of the country, and I did not grow up in a musical family at all. I grew up in a suburb of Boston in Massachusetts and had not heard any traditional music that I could be sure to say was traditional music until I was about 22 years old. And I was in Vermont, and I ran into a bunch of fiddlers up there. They call the Champlain Valley Fiddlers Association. And they met on a weekly basis, and that was the first old-time music I ever heard. And their repertoire, it turns out, is very similar to music that you hear in the South, but the style of playing is very different. And the thing that really makes it different is the influence of the banjo. And I practiced at this kind of music for several years, and then I heard some people playing old-time banjo. So a friend of mine had visited the South, came up, and I had learned to play clawhammer banjo. And so I got more and more interested in banjo playing, and finally, in 1976, took a vacation, and I left a sign on my desk at work that said, "Gone to banjo heaven." And I had gone to, that meant I went to West Virginia, and I was in search of banjo players. Well, I came to the town of Elkins in August of 1976, the week after the fourth Augusta Festival had just ended. Everybody said, "Well, you should have been here last week." But as usual, at something like Augusta, there are a few stragglers and enough people still around that I got a flavor of what was happening. But actually, talking about the history of the banjo in Africa, in the current issue of the Banjo Newsletter, of which there are copies over just outside the Augusta office, there's an article by a man who just went to Africa and went to to 14 different countries on the west coast of Africa searching for an instrument like the banjo that was called a banjo, and he couldn't find one. What he found was an instrument that was similar in that it was a hollowed out piece of wood that had a skin stretched over it, but it had five different necks on it with a string going to each one, and it was called a kora. And there was another similar instrument called a pakun, but nothing that sounded like banjo. And he said that the traditions there are pretty well preserved, so that you could assume that something that was an ancient instrument like 300 or 400 years ago when slaves first started coming to the United States would still be apparent. You could still find examples of it. But actually, I would like to play the banjo a little bit to talk a little bit about banjo styles. And it just so happens that there's one up here. I'm going to borrow. Because I, like a lot of other people, have for years been saying the banjo is an African instrument. And now, as we were just sitting here, I was thinking about something which might be part germane to the subject, and that is that in America, slaves were forbidden to have drums. In the Caribbean, they were not.
And consequently, you still have a strong drumming tradition in the Caribbean. But in the United States, they were forbidden to have drums. Well, perhaps the banjo is a drum that's adapted to a musical instrument by slaves who couldn't have a drum. Maybe that's part of what it's all about. Because certainly it is a drum. That's what this part of it is. With the skin stretched over. At first it was a gourd, some kind of hoop made of some kind of material. I've actually seen, there was a fellow last year who had a banjo made out of a cake tin. And who was that fellow in West Virginia had a banjo made out of a Chrysler transmission? Yeah, that's a very popular thing to make banjos out of. So if you're driving Chryslers out there, check your transmissions. But anyway, several times up here, all our Arlie's banjo and musician players have mentioned this claw hammer banjo style. Well, if the banjo was in fact an African instrument, claw hammer banjo represents an African rhythm, which eventually came to pervade all of Southern Mountain music. And the way claw hammer banjo is played is you take your hand and you make it into a claw. And then you hammer down on the strings, rather than picking the strings as you see a bluegrass banjo player. Instead, I'm coming down on the string with my first finger and only my first finger hitting the string, and then every other beat's coming in on this short string, the fifth string, to give a rhythmic effect. And that bum diddy bum diddy bum diddy bum diddy sound is an African rhythm, or I will say, we can speculate that it is an African rhythm, and that particular rhythm came to pervade all of the playing of Southern Mountain fiddlers. So that now if you find a fiddler in West Virginia, the chances are that they know primarily reels, which are tunes in that kind of rhythm. In the Scotch-Irish settlers probably brought with them tunes in many different kinds of rhythms, such as hornpipes and jigs. And a jig is a da 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 1-2-3, 1-2-3 kind of time. And a hornpipe is a slower 4-4 time. Well, all of those rhythms and the tunes in those rhythms got changed over to reel time. That kind of. So let me just play you an example of a tune played in clawhammer style. Another one of the influences that really is important in the development of mountain music was the minstrel show, which the minstrel shows came all throughout these mountain areas and brought with them their music. And I think that in many ways that was the way the banjo was introduced to mountain communities, was through the minstrel shows. And the minstrel show, it's a real interesting history, because the way minstrel shows started was apparently there was a tradition on plantations where the blacks would do a pantomime or a show in which they would imitate or parody the airs of the white people. And it was at one of these shows that a Britishman, an Englishman, in 1797 saw one of these performances, went back to England and painted his face with a burnt cork and put on blackface and imitated the blacks, but he was imitating the blacks as they were imitating the whites. So it's kind of a double entendre. And that continues through minstrelry, where they would kind of speak in highfalutin airs and call the panel leader the Mr. Interlocutor. And the banjo was played and the bones were played. And I think that because of the pervasiveness of the minstrels, and minstrelry really was one of, if not the most popular form of American music between about 1840 and 1890, and out of that grew vaudeville, really. that the by these minstrel shows going around to the many, many mountain communities, that's where a lot of people picked up the idea of a banjo. They went home and made banjos that were more primitive than what they had seen, but they were still banjos. And they played them and started to play them along with fiddles, and it was then that the influence of the banjo came on the fiddle playing, which was already going on. Now, that's how I speculate that it happened.
Frank?
You guys might not agree.
We'd like to get a little controversy into this discussion.
That's right.
People from Europe certainly didn't bring it with them. So I agree with everything you said so far, pretty much.
No,
you haven't finished.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, because another...
As far as it goes.
On that same trip, one of the people I was really looking for was Frank George, because he was someone I'd read about and heard records of, and his tunes are written down in books and by different people. Because part of really what's going on in Appalachian music is there really has been a pretty tremendous revival of it.
A lot of thieves.
A lot of thieves, right? Well, I came to visit Frank George, the great master of banjo fiddle playing. I found him on a hot August day watching I Love Lucy reruns in his underwear.
Was I drinking anything?
Not supposed to tell everything. Well, I'm just into the facts, you know. But anyway.
I think it was in my lab.
And I came in and I said, I want to hear something about this Appalachian music. And he stopped me right there. And there's a little controversy for you, Frank. I know you like to talk about that.
Appalachian is the way you say it.
Good.
Only Yankees say Appalachia.
Because up there they say, well, but there are Appalachian mountains in New England. And that
the
and up there is simply the way they're pronounced.
Well, they go all the way from Gaspé Peninsula down into Alabama.
Right. But somewhere around about the Mason-Dixon line, you have to flatten that A.
Right.
Okay, or you'll get in trouble, as I did.
It's an Indian word, I'm told, means endless mountain chain, but that does happen to have an end on each end.
If you have any questions at this point that you would like to address to anybody here, please feel free to do that. We'd like to...
Bill, I'm curious, have you ever seen the painting? I can recall the date, but I can't recall where it was done, but it was an itinerant folk painter, and it was one of the earliest documentations of the banjo that we have, and it's a black man playing the banjo with blacks dancing around. I know I can visualize the women having like bandanas on their head, and there's like,
I've got a copy of that.
Yeah, they're playing bones, yeah.
Approximately
18. Yeah, and of course it's a little gourd banjo, and it's three strings, as I recall from whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, I remember hearing, maybe you can document, I remember hearing somewhere where some anthropologists from the state of Connecticut had gone to South Carolina to study slavery on a plantation, like Revolutionary War, some, you know, in that era and time, and making notes in their journals, not only making notes, but even sketching this instrument, that this peculiar instrument that they ran into. And I can't recall where that, I'll have to dig around and see if I can find, but you know, it was like the first recorded observation, of it by people who were...
But Thomas Jefferson wrote of it in his journals.
I'll say the earliest well-known person I could find that wrote about the banjo was T.J.
And he called it a banjar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, we call it banjur, so you all don't even know how to say it. Banjur.
I've got a question for Jimmy Costa, if I could. In the movie Mate One, as I understood the point they were making, and I know that's near and dear to your heart, as I understood it, they seem to say that the mandolin was brought into these mountains and became a part of the mountain music from the Italians that came over. And then you can see the fiddle player saying, boy, what is it that he's playing there, and that the music influenced each other. Is that historical fact? Is that speculation?
I don't know if that was implicated or not. What I know about the mandolin is that it never, some of the Italians could have brought it, but it tends to be in the mountain households only until the advent of mail order catalogs, and they saw them in there, which they were old taterbug bowbacks, European style. So I don't know about any direct influence or the Italians bringing them with them. Possibly could have happened. My grandfather played mandolin in the old country. He didn't bring one with him, but I know he played one. But as far as, I don't know that.
Another big influence
in bringing other instruments into the mountains, especially the guitar and the mandolin, I think, was the coming of the Industrial Revolution, you know, around the turn of the century, the timber industry and the coal industry, and of course that relates to what we're talking about here, and that's when a lot of the immigrants came in from Italy to work the railroads. But at the same time, there were people coming from all over the country into this area. And I remember Lee Hammonds telling me he had never seen a guitar until he was in his 20s working
about
the lumber camps.
World War One.
That's what I hear people say.
Saw their first guitar.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the World War
They were in homes in Hinton before 1900, but only the elite, middle income elite people had them.
Yeah.
There were two in the old Hinton house. I have one, yeah. 1890s, you know, so
probably
that's the only place. Yeah. That was
so this would have been, what, in the 19-teens there, when Lee would have been 20.
So.
Yeah,
in
something
Clay
like
County,
that.
The Dal Moore said the first guitar anybody ever could remember is about World War One.
That's right.
It was probably a mail order one, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to that picture, we've studied it under magnifying glasses, and it appears to be a wooden structure. I don't think it's a gourd. It's kind of a wooden head, but it's definitely a banjo. B-A-N-J-E-R.
It's round looking, isn't it? Isn't it real round looking?
Yeah, it may be a gourd, but it doesn't quite look like it. Hmm. But up here on the neck, there appears to be a thumb string or fifth string. However, on the neck, which is not fretted, there are only three strings.
That's right.
So what happened, in my opinion, is when they added the fifth string, it was the bass, or what we call the fourth string. The fifth one wasn't added, it was the fourth one that was added.
Hmm.
So take the fourth one off sometime. You'd be surprised the fun you'll have with those three strings and the thumb string. It's
I'd
great.
I'd like to ask about